From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with German conductor Helmut Rilling. He's devoted much of his life to performing and recording Bach's sacred music. Author Diane Johnson talks about her first novel in 8 years. It was inspired by Johnson's own experiences as an American in Iran on the eve of the revolution. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward takes a look at one of rock's underrated lyricists. And book critic John Leonard reviews the latest novel by South African writer Nadine Gordimer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest on Fresh Air is conductor Helmut Rilling. Rilling has won an international reputation as a conductor of the Baroque repertoire. But it's not for the novelty of his interpretations, nor for his adherence to the original instrumentation that he's well known. Instead, it's for his attention to the spiritual message that Bach's music conveys. Rilling's readings of the text spring from a lifelong immersion in Germany's sacred choral literature. His own background parallels the tradition in which Bach worked. His father was a Lutheran pastor, and he was educated in Protestant seminaries. He studied music at the Stuttgart Conservatory, and throughout his professional life he has continued to work as a church musician. In 1976, Rilling became the first German conductor to lead the Israel Philharmonic. He spends considerable time conducting in America. He's recorded all of the Bach cantatas, and we're about to hear one of the lesser-known ones. Helmut Rilling, welcome to Fresh Air. Before we talk about your music and your life, I want to play the opening from Bach's cantata 143. Would you introduce it for us?
You choose a very unknown cantata of Bach. Cantata 143 is one of the earliest cantatas Bach has written, and there are some scholars who even doubt that it's really Bach's own composition. You hear a very brilliant piece, but it still is a piece where Bach, if he has written it really, has not yet developed the full skills of his abilities to compose with choir and brilliantly thought out orchestra.
But you liked it enough to record it.
You see, we recorded all the cantatas of Bach, all the 200 church cantatas, and among them also the unknown cantatas, and some of them which are not really secured in their relationship to Bach himself. And so cantata 143 is one of them.
Well, let's hear the opening from Bach's cantata 143 with my guest Helmut Rilling conducting. My guest Helmut Rilling conducting the opening of Bach's cantata 143. You've conducted all of the sacred works of Bach. Did your religion lead you to Bach or vice versa?
Well, this is a question which I, in that direction, could not answer. I come from a background which has both traditions, the musical ones and the theological ones. The family of my mother goes back with Lutheran ministers to the age of the Reformation, and the family of my father and also branches of the family of my mother have been musicians for a long time. So I have both things in my blood, so to say. I was always interested in music. I was always interested in theology, philosophy, and of course in Bach's music these two things come together. And so I have taken quite a lot of time in studying these both things in Bach's life work, especially in his sacred music, in his 200 cantatas which we have from him, in his oratorios, and many of those smaller pieces which he has written.
It seems like it's become a calling for you to record and perform the sacred works of Bach.
You see, there are some pieces of Bach on these topics which are very well known. Take the St. Matthew Passion, take the St. John Passion, or the B minor Mass. But from these 200 cantatas, only very few are known. But still, J.S. Bach has his central goal in composing cantatas. He composed cantatas for every Sunday during the church year. And so if one wants to know Bach really, one must know his cantatas. And that's what I tried to do. And it took me a long time for doing this. See, when you record a piece, then you first must study it yourself. You must make up your mind how to do it. Then you must start the rehearsals with the choir, with the orchestra, with the soloists. Then you record the piece. And of course, for a good recording, you do every piece, say, 6, 7, 8, 9 times. Then after the recording session, you sit down with the engineers and you slice it together, take the best parts of every session. And then after this is over, you listen to the sample of the finished recording. And after that, you know the piece quite well. And I did this with all these 200 cantatas, also with the oratorios. And after 15 years, in 85, we finished for the Bach tricentennial with that. After these 15 years, I dare to say that I'm somehow, somewhat like a Bach specialist.
Yeah, I think that's not an understatement. When did Bach's music start speaking to you? I mean, it really has a hold over you.
Well, as I told you, I grew up in a family where music, and especially Bach's music, was very important. And so I heard a lot of that music in my childhood already. But I didn't want, first of all, to become a musician. I had other interests, and when I became a musician, I was sort of afraid because I thought the music of Bach was too difficult, too great for me, and I should first do many other things before being able to perform Bach. So I turned to very old music. I did a lot of 20th century music. And finally, I dared to do something and then more and got more into it. And when I got the job to record all those cantatas, I thought, this is wonderful. Now you will have the chance to really look into things very deeply.
Your life parallels Bach in a way, in that through his life and through most of your adult life, you have each conducted church choirs and been very musically active in the church.
Well, there is a great difference. Bach is a genius, one of the greatest composers of all times. I'm not a composer, I'm a conductor, and I am interested in that music. You are right, in some ways there are parallels. I have been educated in seminars, in schools where music and theology both were very important. And when I started my musical career, I started it as an organist and choir master at one of the churches in Stuttgart, which is my hometown in the south of Germany. And I'm still today what they call there a cantor, that is the man who is responsible for the music in church. And through the years where I worked at the Gedächtniskirche Memorial Church in Stuttgart, I had all these duties which Bach had as his time also, that is, conducting the choirs, conducting the orchestra, making up a program for the church music, educate children in church music, and so on. And maybe, and you said that, and I think it's right, you need something of that for understanding really the purpose of that music. I mean, Bach's music is not written just as music, but it has a very special purpose. It has to serve the very ideas of the service in which it is going to be heard. And this goes for the cantatas. This goes, for example, also for the St. Matthew Passion, for the St. John Passion. Both of these big pieces were also composed for church services at Bach's lifetime.
You've become internationally known as a conductor, yet you still conduct the choir in the church. And I wonder if there are certain pleasures for you or a certain spiritual connection for you to do music in a church as opposed to a secular setting.
For me, that music is very meaningful. You see, there is so much music nowadays where you say, I'll do it, but what it really says, what it wants to say, is not that important to me. And for me, I think it is important that the music which you perform and with which you identify, that this carries some meaning for you and carries some truth for you. And I think it's wonderful to have such music in Bach's church music.
We know what I'm thinking, too. Some people who don't think of themselves as concert goers, who don't have subscription tickets to the orchestra or whatever, will hear music in church. And it's not the kind of, you know, you put on your best clothes and you go out to a performance on Saturday night and wait to be entertained. You're hearing the music on a very different level when you hear it in a church. And I wonder if people are more open to the music in a way in that kind of setting.
I think you're right. This is very worthwhile to have a different way of listening to good music than just going to a concert because you want to be entertained. It has also problems. You see, music in church can be quite mediocre. And the audiences in church maybe sometimes would not be able to understand what is very well performed and what is just average. And this is one thing which for me was always very important. I said to me, if a composer of the high level of J.S. Bach composed such wonderful church music, then we would have to do our very, very best to perform that music on the same level. That is, not be happy with what you just have at hands and with the little rehearsal time you might get for a given performance in church, but really to try out for the very best, for the highest standards, for the best quality. And if this comes together with what I would call the trying to understand the meaning, the message of these pieces, then it is very worthwhile to dedicate to such things a life work. I'm also very interested to say that I would think it a big mistake if you would want to perform this kind of music only in churches. I'm traveling quite a lot, and I think it is very important that also those people who do not go to churches, or in countries where there are no churches or no possibilities for people to attend church services, that they still should hear that music. Take Japan. I have been in Japan very often, and I have done a lot of Bach's music in Japan, not only the big oratorios, and also on an academy level, on a workshop level, explaining the meaning of the cantatas. And there, of course, it is quite a different situation, because all the contents of the text are not known, and you must explain them too. But still, I think this kind of music, which is rooted in the European Christian tradition, has a wonderful way to explain to people from other cultures what the Western civilization is about. And I had this impression very strongly in Japan. I had it also in the socialist countries, where in some respects the situation is not very much different, as church music usually is very seldom heard. But I remember the incredible atmosphere in Moscow or in Prague or in Warsaw, where he performed Bach's B minor Mass or his St. Matthew Passion. And the message went also beyond the borders of ideology in that direction.
We're going to hear another performance of one of your recordings of the Bach cantata in a moment. But first, we're going to take a very short break, and we'll be back in a few seconds. My guest is conductor Helmut Rilling, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is conductor Helmut Rilling. He specializes in the Baroque repertoire, more specifically in Bach. He has recorded all of Bach's sacred music, and that was a 15-year project. He conducts around the world and lives in Stuttgart, Germany, where he leads the church choir that he founded when he was 21. I'd like to listen to another recording of a performance that you did of another Bach cantata, and this is from the cantata 199. And we're going to hear soprano Arlene Auger singing the recitative from My Heart Swims in Blood. It's a beautiful but very dark piece. At least it reads dark to me, and I wonder what it says to you.
You see, Bach, of course, has many ways of expressing himself in his music, and he can do that in a very brilliant way with a full orchestra, with trumpets, and in major keys and the full chorus. But of course, he has also other attitudes toward resolving his human problems, speaking out with his music. And one of the examples for that is the beginning of Cantata 199, Mein Herz schwimmt im Blut, My Heart Swims in Blood. This is similar to pieces like many from the St. Matthew Passion or the St. John Passion, where you have the same somber mood, a mood of sorrow, which later in the same cantata will be resolved into joy.
Let's hear Arlene Auger, soprano, in this performance of the recitative from My Heart Swims in Blood from Bach's cantata 199, my guest Helmut Rilling conducting.
Oh!
We heard the opening recitative from My Heart Swims in Blood, Bach's Cantata number 199. Arlene Auger was the soprano. My guest, Helmut Rilling, conducted. It's really a very beautiful piece. You've been involved in religion and music, I think, all of your life. As you mentioned before, your father was a Lutheran minister, and you studied in seminaries. Now, I know a lot of people who were brought up in the religious life who also love music want to break out of that and perform secular music. Did such thoughts ever enter your mind?
Oh, sure. And I do perform a lot of secular music. Maybe you put the impact a little too much on the Lutheran, on the religious, on the Bach side. I'm doing a lot of other music too. For example, I do quite a lot of opera and have done a lot of secular music with chorus and orchestra, a cappella music of many different composers from the 19th century. For example, I did Boito Mephistophele, which certainly is a piece which has nothing to do with Bach at all.
You were born in 1933, and grew up just at the time that the Nazis were coming to power, and your early years they were in power. Was your exposure to religious music colored at all by the Nazis being in power? And I'd like to know, too, if Bach was in favor by the German government then.
Oh, I don't recall that. See, I was still too young for being able to understand that. When the war was over, I was not yet 12 years old. I know that after the war, in these first terrible years where there was Germany all in ruins and there was nothing existing anymore, that there the music of Bach was for many people a great help to come to grips again with a way how to go on and live. I remember this from my parents. But I couldn't tell what the situation in regards to Bach's music during the Third Reich was.
You're one of the few German conductors that have been invited to conduct in Israel. Was that a connection that you tried to bring up yourself?
I got the invitation from the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra. I didn't try to get it, and they just invited my choir and myself as a conductor to come there and to work together with them. And we had a series of concerts at that time. It was in 76, I think, in Tel Aviv, in Jerusalem, in Haifa, where we did concerts, choral, orchestral works. The most important work was Johannes Brahms' German Requiem. And I felt it to be a great honor that the Israelis invited me to do that. I remember very well when I came to that very first rehearsal and I asked the director of the orchestra what kind of language should I speak in that rehearsal. Then he said, "They understand best German, but I would not suggest that you use that language in rehearsal because they don't like it." But we became very good friends. And since this first appearance in Israel, we have gone there. My chorus, about 100 people from the Gechinger Kantorei, have gone to Israel 4 times and had also the Israel Orchestra as our guests in Germany, and we have become very good friends.
You are conducting a lot of Bach's work at a time when many conductors are returning to authentic instruments, and it's become a whole movement now of returning to the original instruments and the exact orchestrations that were written at the time. You know, you're not really doing that. I mean, for instance, a lot of the cantatas were written for boy choirs, and you're using adults and a mix of men and women. Where do you stand on the original instruments movement?
I think for every conductor performing this kind of music in our times, it is absolutely necessary to know about the performance practice of the time of the composer, in this case, J.S. Bach. And I think one must know how many people he used in his choir, in his orchestra, what kind of voices he had, what kind of instruments he had, what the reverberance in the church was, and so on. Dynamics, articulation, phrasings, the theoretical remarks of musicologists of that time. But if you would be able to recreate really exactly the sound as it was at that time, then this would not yet be a complete reconstruction, because the other part of that reconstruction would not be the same, and this is the audience. And I think the audience since, say, 1725 and today has changed so completely that I think it's not enough to recreate a sound which will not reach the listener in the same situation as at Bach time. So I think it is very important that you ask, what is the very sense of that music? What did the composer have in mind? What did he want to bring out? And to try to transpose this message of a past time into our time. Because we are making that music not for a museum, but for people who should be touched by it, who would understand the message, the sense behind. The sense could be joy, just general joy, or could be sorrow, just in a very general way. But of course, as we are dealing with artworks, it can be much, can go much beyond that, and can go in deeper levels of our thinking, of our feeling, of our conscience even.
So you want to be true to some larger truth, not just to the exact letter of the score.
Exactly that. I think it is a beautiful thing that we have many ways of doing these pieces in our days. But we should never forget about the most important thing, that is, what does it mean? What is the idea behind?
Helmut Rilling, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your life and music with us today. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for this good interview.
Thank you for being here. My guest has been conductor Helmut Rilling, who has devoted much of his musical life to recording and performing the sacred music of Bach. He conducts around the world and lives in Stuttgart, Germany. This is Fresh Air. Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting Radio Fund. Additional funding comes from NPR member stations and their listeners to WHYY in Philadelphia. This is NPR National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up on Fresh Air, author Diane Johnson talks about what it was like to be an American in Iran on the eve of the revolution. Her experiences there led to her latest novel, Persian Nights. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says it's time one of rock's legends was as well known for his lyrics as he is for his beat. And book critic John Leonard reviews Nadine Gordimer's latest novel, A Sport of Nature. It's about a young woman's sexual and political awakening in South Africa. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, this news. This is Fresh Air. In rock and roll, the lyrics often take a backseat to the beat. Some people say they can't understand the words, others just don't pay them any attention. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward wants us to hear the words behind one of the most popular beats in rock and roll history.
I walk 47 miles of barbed wire. I use a cobra snake for a necktie. I've got a brand new house by the roadside, made from rattlesnake hide. It's got a brand new chimney up on top, made out of human skulls. Come on, take a little walk with me, Arlene, and tell me, who do you love? Who do you love?
Miles of barbed wire. I use a cobra snake for a necktie. I got a brand new house on the roadside, made from rattlesnake hide. I got a brand new chimney made on top, made out of a human skull. Now come on, take a little walk with me, Arlene, and tell me, who do you love? Who do you love? Who do you love?
What in the world is that bit of verse? It's the work of an American folk poet whose words are often overlooked in light of his more famous achievement, Bo Diddley. Bo Diddley was born Elias McDaniel on the next to last day of 1928 and moved to Chicago with his stepmother when he was five. The almost wholesale migration of black Southerners to Chicago's South Side kept the youngster in touch with the rich verbal traditions of his Mississippi birthplace, and he probably heard the same jump rope chants, ring dances, and play party songs that folklorist Alan Lomax was collecting in the South at about that same time. Chicago probably had a local equivalent of a strange instrument that Southern kids used to accompany these verses, a wire attached to a broomstick on one end and a door or wall on the other. You'd draw it tight, adjust the tension with the broom, and twang it like a mouthbow or jew's harp, using a distinctive rhythm. It was called a lot of things, but one thing it was called was a Bo Diddley. Elias McDaniel learned the guitar in Chicago, but in order to support his wife and kids, he became a boxer. Hanging around the gym, he probably took part in another famous black verbal tradition, the dozens, a game in which insults are traded, the filthier and more personal the better, at least until your fellow player decides you've gone too far. But he wasn't quite the boxer he thought he was, so McDaniel tried music again. On March 2, 1955, he found himself in the studios of Chess Records, Chicago's top blues label, recording a song that fused Mississippi and Chicago, his childhood and his adulthood, into a 2.5-minute romp of bragging and good humor. He used the name he'd boxed under and the beat of the broomstick and called it Bo Diddley.
He gonna take it to a private eye. If that private eye can't see, he better not take the ring from me.
Soon, Bo Diddley and his two-man band, Jerome Green on maracas and insults, and Frank Kirkland on drums, were big stars, enjoying a string of hits through 1962, most of them featuring that Bo Diddley beat. With his square and fur-covered guitars, his outrageous stage act, and his thick glasses, nobody ever took Bo seriously, but I think it's time to reassess Bo Diddley as a folk poet. Certainly the imagery of Who Do You Love is surreal enough, and then there are the nursery rhyme songs like Bo Diddley and Puttin' and Tane. Bo Diddley buying his baby a billy goat just to make her a Sunday coat is part of the same jump rope song that gave us Charlie and Inez Fox's Mockingbird, after all. And Bo's songs of the dozens, Say Man Back Again, and Bo's Vacation, are as close as most of us will get to that street sport, as Bo tells Jerome that Jerome's girlfriend has everything a man would want, a mustache, a hairy chest. But my favorite Bo Diddley songs are the made-up stories. Background to Music is the story of a B-flat looking for work as a background. And then there are the two flies who keep the garbage man away by talking tough. There's Greasy Spoon, where the menu includes such items of new American cuisine as barbecued alligator navels or the surrealist cowboy Yuval Green. There's much more to Bo Diddley than that irresistible rhythm in the tales of sexual braggadocio, something that gives us a glimpse at a past we may not fully understand, as in the tale I'll leave you with of the great-grandfather.
The great-grandpappy, when the land was young, barred his door with a wagon tongue. When the times got tough and the Redskins mob said his prayers with a shotgun cock. Great grandpappy was a busy man, cooked his grub in a frying pan, picked his teeth with a hunting knife, he wore the same suit all his life.
That's Bo Diddley's The Great Grandfather. Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle and is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. His comments on rock history are a regular feature of our show.
Hey man,
what's that boy?
I want to tell you about your girlfriend.
What about my girl?
But you don't look strong enough to take the message.
I'm strong enough.
I might hurt your feelings.
My feelings already hurt by being here with you.
This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Diane Johnson is a novelist, biographer, screenwriter, and essayist. Her last book was a biography of mystery writer Dashiell Hammett. She co-wrote the screenplay for the movie The Shining, and her essays have appeared in the New York Times and the New York Review of Books. Persian Nights is her first novel in 8 years. The story is set in Iran, just a few months before the downfall of the Shah. The heroine, Chloe Fowler, is an American who comes to Iran unprepared for the great drama that is about to unfold. Her experiences loosely parallel Johnson's own.
The circumstances that took me to Iran were much like those that happened to Chloe, who's the heroine of the book. That is, my doctor husband was to be a visiting professor at the medical school in Shiraz, which was part of a program at that period between the University of California and this Iranian medical school. So we found ourselves there in the role of helper teachers and so on. I was just tagging along.
The heroine in your novel remains politically oblivious most of the time that she's in Iran. She's occupied with an affair that she's having, with making her apartment look nice. Did you witness that kind of detachment a lot? Did you find that a lot of Americans in Iran were slightly oblivious to the revolution that was about to happen in the country?
Absolutely. And that was one of the things that interested me, again, in retrospect, and because I'm sure at the time I was as interested as Chloe in trying to guess what the women felt like wrapped in their shawls or going to the bazaar, seeing what the life of the people was like. you didn't really sense the imminence of the revolution, or rather, you thought that if there was going to be an uprising, the Shah would just kill everyone. You know, that there were these visible troops and heavy military presence, and you assumed that the people either would not uprise because they themselves could see that they would be shot, or that it would end badly for them if they did. And it doesn't really affect you day to day. I think that's why people are always getting caught in revolutions. You still have to go to the store and somehow, like all those people in Beirut, you know, and you wonder how they could possibly live. But in fact, they have to go to the store and buy their oranges and their cornmeal. And so did you in Iran at that period. So that's what you did. It was funny.
Several of your novels show your interest in the sudden intrusion of violence into a life that had been protected from violence. In this case, it's the violence of the Shah's regime and the developing revolution. Why are you so interested in that intrusion of violence into a life?
Well, I think because as Americans, except poor Americans, we normally don't have violence in our lives. Or if we do, it runs counter to what we expect of life, even though violence is becoming an increasing reality in the lives of all Americans. We still somehow have the expectation that it won't intrude upon sort of calm middle-class American life.
A few years ago, you wrote a biography of Dashiell Hammett. Is your interest in danger or violence at all connected with your interest in his work?
No, I don't think so at all. My interest in him was really in his life as a style, in his particularly American style and that sort of literary style of the 30s, and in the detective story as a genre and in its development. The whole Hollywood connection in his life, which I thought was interesting.
In the New York Times, you once described Wuthering Heights by Charlotte Bronte as one of the books you would have most liked to have written yourself. And I'm interested, you know, that you're interested in Hammett, who's such the quintessential American male writer, and in Bronte, who's such a quintessential female writer, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess I was wondering if you were interested in the male and female voices in literature, and if you find them to be very different.
Well, I am interested in that. I don't find them to be very different. Or, well, the voice isn't different. The subjects are different. I'm just in the process of writing a review for the New York Times of a new biography of Hemingway, and it was interesting that when they called me up and said, you know, do you feel like doing this, they said, we haven't had a woman write about Hemingway before. And that struck me as true. Maybe that's what really, charmed me and gave me the idea that it would be fun to do. When you think about it, women never write about Hemingway. I think there is a kind of segregation in American letters which can be consciously overcome, but it isn't apt to be unless people think about it. Now, I notice that a lot of the reviews of Persian Nights have been by women. Not all of them, by any means, but because I think book review editors, you know, send books by women to review. That this is a completely unconscious thing, which they can break the habit of, but that it preserves a kind of segregation which encourages us to think that the voices are different when they're not, really.
In a way, I think what you've done in Persian Nights is to subvert the historical romance genre. And I don't know if you'd see that as being true at all, but let me explain what I mean. On one level, we have a heroine who journeys to an exotic land without her husband, has an affair, against the backdrop of developing revolution. But on the other hand, we realize how trivial in some ways her affair is compared to what's happening politically, and she feels herself to be totally lacking in mystery and flamboyance. Were you doing that at all? Do you feel you were subverting that genre?
Yeah, well, I hoped take the best parts of it, and then, yes, to show the very thing that you just said. I mean, you're absolutely right. To show how trivial maybe her concerns were, her expectations for excitement, compared to the historical drama that she wasn't even prepared to understand was happening or to notice.
Persian Nights is your first novel in 8 years. Now, I know you wrote the Hammett book in between and you did a lot of essay writing in between, but did you ever go through that fear that a lot of writers have of, uh-oh, was that my last novel? Is there another one left in me?
No, I didn't. I think if I had known about this if I'd consciously thought it would be 8 years before I published another novel, I would have felt very anxious and been busy writing a novel. As it was, the time just sort of slipped by, and now I come upon this rather reproachful statement. Why haven't you been working at your novel writing 8 years? And so now I'm going to be more diligent, I think, and not do some other things.
You co-authored the screenplay of The Shining with Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah.
My favorite moment in the movie is in the scene where, you know, Nicholson, the Jack Nicholson character, has been shooing away his wife, saying that he's busy, he's writing, she should leave him alone and not intrude. And he's carrying on like he's writing the great American novel. And finally, the camera shows us what he's been writing, and he has pages and pages of "All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy."
Yes.
And it's after we realize what he's been writing that he really starts to go mad. I've always seen that movie as a horror story about writer's block.
Yes, that was very much how I saw it, too. I don't think that that's what Stephen King intended, perhaps, but it was sort of the side of it that emerged, not only my perception of it, but probably Kubrick's, too, making his first film in several years and being preoccupied with this whole business of, you know, the artist, the blocking or flowing of creativity and so on.
Do you have another novel in the works?
Yes, I do. I'm writing a novel. I'm kind of going on with doctors, a subject that I know a lot about. And this one is, however, just set in San Francisco in a hospital.
I find it interesting that your next novel and your current novel both have doctor characters in it. Your husband's a doctor. It's
yes.
As if, you know, you're writing and you're alone in this room with your typewriter every day and you're relying on him to, like, take you to the outside world for subject matter.
Yeah. Well, in a way, that's true. I mean, I think that any woman writer would have to rely on her life as a wife or her life as a schoolteacher or her life, whatever it is, life outside the writer's room. But that's true for men writers, too. You have to, I mean, it's a negotiation between the real world and yourself and the typewriter. And if you always stayed in with your typewriter, you wouldn't have anything to write about. I think that's actually the problem with a lot of writers, that they retreat too much from outside experience, and then they can't get anything further to come.
And then there's nothing there larger than their own thoughts.
And there's nothing larger than their, yes, exactly. And it's become so solipsistic and finally so enervating to reader and writer both.
Great. Diane Johnson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Diane Johnson, her new novel is called Persian Nights. This is Fresh Air. Stay tuned for full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts All Things Considered. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What are some of the stories you're following this evening?
Well, the Supreme Court ruled today that the federal government can require that some foreign films display the label political propaganda, and Nina Totenberg will be reporting on that story. Also, the board of the PTL met today in South Carolina, and afterwards, Reverend Jerry Falwell announced he would remain as head of PTL amid rumors that Jim Baker was trying to reclaim his ministry.
Who will you be speaking to on today's show?
Well, I'll be talking to University of California folklorist Alan Dundies about cracking jokes.
Okay, well, that sounds interesting. Thank you very much, Renee. All Things Considered is coming up later today from National Public Radio. The crackdown on the flow of information in South Africa affects all its citizens, black and white. South African novelist Nadine Gordimer has experienced censorship firsthand. Over the past 30 years, three of her novels were banned by the government. Her latest novel is called Sport of Nature. Critic John Leonard has this review.
Nadine Gordimer is white, female, English, and liberal in South Africa. She has always told the complicated truth about her native land, which is why so many of her books have been banned there. What's amazing is that the books get better as the situation gets worse. Her new novel, A Sport of Nature, is a commanding performance, dense, wise, beautiful, crafty, intoxicated by ideas and colors, and very bloody. The revolution, when it comes to South Africa, will do violence to body as well as mind. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, a sport of nature is an abnormal variation or a departure from the parent stock or type, a spontaneous mutation, a new variety. That almost sounds like a revolution, doesn't it? But Gordimer's sport of nature is a woman, Helela, a white South African named for her Zionist grandfather, deserted by her dreamy romantic mother, raised by aunts who were variously rich and silly, or conscience-stricken and politically dangerous, an adventuress on three continents who goes to bed with men and wakes up with history. Helela is not an intellectual. She lives entirely in the present tense. She trusts nothing she hasn't personally experienced through her body. The body pressed upon becomes a book, a kind of instruction manual. Reading herself, Helela invents a future in which there is no more room for white South Africans. Helela's body, over four hectic decades in a dozen countries, is pressed upon by many men. There is her cousin Sasha, who goes to prison for organizing black mine workers, and the Canadian journalist and police spy who abandons her in exile, and the French ambassador who shares her with his children, and the black revolutionary who fathers her daughter and dies in her kitchen. There is also the Eastern European Minister of Culture who translates some more Neruda every time he goes to jail, and the American WASP who, from his New York brownstone, manages the merchandising of Helela on the do-good liberal circuit as a sort of third-world white Madonna with a black African child. And finally, there is that face on the postage stamp, the once-and-future Catholic nationalist Marxist African-made president of a new black nation who will choose her for his queen and return her in secret triumph to a South Africa utterly changed, itself a sport of nature. Most of these men, oddly enough, have read Dostoevsky, and each of them teaches Helela whatever he knows about sex, class, color, law, education, economics, art, animals, vegetation, hypocrisy, and terrorism. She eludes the men and their definitions and finds herself and rewrites history to include tough love. The world is full of writers, and many of them are intelligent, but very few seem to know as much as Nadine Gordimer. In a sport of nature, from the abrasions of politics on personality, like Marquez, Kundera, Soyinka, Solzhenitsyn, Günter Grass, and Doris Lessing, she makes a savage marvel.
John Leonard reviews television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. And that's our show for today. On the next Fresh Air, my guest will be Joe Horowitz, whose study of conductor Arturo Toscanini charts the rise of classical music's star machine. I'll also speak with British novelist Julian Barnes, author of the acclaimed Flaubert's Parrot, and a new novel, Staring at the Sun. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review a new compact disc reissue of performances by pianist Arthur Schnabel. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will describe the Meryl Streepification of Hollywood accents. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting Radio Fund. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia.
Fresh Air is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistant is Ed Doherty. The engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name is Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.